Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Next month, the Leander Public Library will not hold what it billed as drag queen story time. Overnight, several right-wing websites and outspoken activists started sharing a flyer promoting the event. The library invited people on June 15th to, quote, join us for fabulous stories and songs. Libraries all across the country have held similar events with drag queens to promote tolerance and acceptance of others. Those events, though, have drawn both support and pushback, including in neighboring states like Arkansas and Louisiana. One Leander mother told us that she could not wait to bring her son to this event when she heard about it Wednesday. She's now disappointed to learn about its cancellation and has a message to whomever made that decision.
It's really upsetting to think that people can be excluded because of who they are or because of what they wear. It's nothing more than that. It's just somebody coming in a fancy outfit to read stories to little kids.
Is that really what it's about? Really? So is that the way transgendered persons or drag queens would describe themselves? Just people who wear funny costumes? I think that's wrong, factually. They certainly don't describe themselves that way. It's a lot more complex than that. But do you see how the left and these progressive parents, I mean, I don't know how they found, like, they found one person who would be so excited about this. But that's how they have to sell it. Oh, don't worry. It's just for the kids. It's just a nice story hour. This is so cute. Isn't this fun? It's just a clown dressed like someone else. We like costumes. We use them on Halloween and in masquerade parties. What is this really all about, though? Well, the Washington Post has a piece, and it's, you know, typical bias claptrap from the Washington Post. But it has a piece about this drag queen story time issue, which is, it's kind of, you know what I describe it as? This is the new challenge to the Christian Baker story. You wonder, well, why, if, you know, a gay couple can go anywhere for a cake, why do they seek a, you know, some type of controversy with the one baker they know who is, like, I don't know, born again Christian and doesn't want to make, like, why are they pushing this? It's just a coincidence? And why is this happening in other forums, a flower arranger, or, you know, is it just, this is just random stuff that's happened? No, it's not random. This is a concerted effort on the part, and the Washington Post makes this point. It's a concerted effort on the part of San Francisco activists to spread the tolerance. This is what they call it, the tolerance. What it really is, I think, foisting San Francisco values on the rest of the country. That you parents are going to get numb to this. Everyone will, and especially kids. This is just like everybody, you know, the drag queen's just like everybody else. So don't, this, if you don't like the drag queen, then you don't like anything. You are not a tolerant good person. So you must love the drag queen story time. You must bring your child. If you object to this in any way, shape, or form, you're part of the Trump atmosphere of intolerance and hatred toward people who aren't like you. The other, as the left likes to call it, the other. But what you really find when you dig down into these types of stories is that they're being foisted upon the country with a clear agenda. This is agenda-driven cultural politics here. And it's wrapped up as, oh, this is just for the kids. Isn't this nice? It's done for the kids. Well, this is done to change the kids and the, perhaps even in some cases, the parents' perceptions of gender and traditional norms of gender and understanding of gender and so forth. And so by the time the kid gets into high school or college, there's been a long period of, you know, becoming, you know, acclimatized, acclimated, I should say, to this understanding of the fluidity of gender and the idea of man and woman and masculine and feminine. That's out the window. No. That's old. That's yesterday. No. This is part of the new atmosphere, the new environment in which you must embrace it in order to be truly compassionate, I should say, human being. Otherwise, you're just one of these religious, intolerant, holier-than-thou, pious, narrow-minded troglodyte types who don't like their kids, who claim that they don't like their kids to be sexualized at a young age and exposed to new sexual understandings, even though the parents who think, well, why are you doing this in a public library? Why do little kids have to be introduced to these visions of the changing fluid world of gender? Why? Why are you going after the kids this way? That's what a lot of the parents are saying in these comments. But those parents are treated like complete pariahs in the dominant media culture. So in the Washington Post, the story is always framed as, well, the intolerant Christian right stands up and says no to the poor drag queens. How dare they? But then there's also some tidbits buried in the story. The organization Drag Queen Story Hour, it's actually an organization's name, started in late 2015 in San Francisco. Ready? This is the Washington Post piece. This is the rise of Trump, right? Just as the country's reinvigorated right wing was coming to form. But it has found many fans with chapters in areas outside traditionally liberal cities. It now has outposts. I mean, they have an office in places like Milwaukee, New Orleans, Charlotte, Mobile, Alabama, and San Marcos, Texas. Its founders have described it as a reaction to the harsh political landscape of the past few years, in which painful debates about issues like identity, sexuality, and race have animated the country's politics. Think about just that writing, that sense. In other words, if anyone disagrees with what the left is doing on issues of gender, race, or anything else for that matter, this is a painful environment that must be confronted directly, face to face, by the drag queens and others. And anyone on the other side is a horrible, awful, rotten person. That's just it. That's what this is. But what the real goal here, and I'm, you know, reading all these message boards on this, the real goal here is the kids. If you get the kids, whether they're in a public school and suddenly you have, you know, a day where a 6-year-old who was John the day before comes to school as Jane or Jeanette, and you have to call the boy now Jeanette because of that's what the boy identifies. That's the new introduction at a young age to children who, you know, they don't understand. They're just little kids. They just want to be kids. And what I would say to all of this is, why are you doing this to the children? Why do you feel like you have to subject children to adult themes? And these are adult themes. Don't say it's just a costume. It ain't a costume.
A drag queen is a nightclub performer.
Is a nightclub performer. Thank you very much. And it's been popularized because of RuPaul, and you know, everyone loves RuPaul's music. But this is just what it's, you know, this is what it's all about. And don't disabuse yourself of the notion that this is about, oh, you know, these are just volunteers who want to read stories to kids. No. The Washington Post makes it clear that the founders started this in reaction to Trump. That's what it is. Like, as if Trump talks about, like, gay or any other issues. They don't talk about that. It's silly. Absolutely ridiculous. But that's where we are. It's very, very disturbing. And I think what we're going to continue to see is this effort to sexualize young people. If adults want to, you know, dress up or call themselves different names, I don't care what you do. But don't tell me that my children have to get up and you know, give you a high five for it. Because guess what? Everyone can believe what they want to believe. And what we intend to do on this podcast is to demonstrate how the left, and it's clear at this point, is the most completely intolerant group of folks because of the way that they require you to bow down. And if you don't bow down to this, you're an intolerant, bigoted, horrible, awful, rotten person. Except, by the way, the church that they said saved this story hour is the United Church of Christ, which is, as you know, the most left-wing church in the United States has, you know, pushed a lot of these types of issues over the years. So that's just where we are on that. But drag queen story hour. So it's a new Christian Baker challenge to the Christian Baker story. I want to thank all of our sponsors on this Laura Ingraham podcast, Janucel, Delta Animal Rescue, and Sheiks. They all help provide this podcast free to you every week. And you're going to learn more about their great products and services coming up in the show. Everyone loves summer, but you can't enjoy summer when you're sleeping on sheets that just trap all the hot and sometimes humid air on your body. You want to stay cool to get rest and to be rejuvenated. That's why I use Sheiks. Sheiks patented sleep tech fabrics breathe 10 times better than traditional cotton sheets, and they keep you cool. They draw moisture away from the body to keep you dry, ensuring a deeper and more restorative night's sleep. Come on, nothing compares to the comfort of Sheiks. And the softness? Oh, it's unbelievable. And you'll wake up feeling recharged and ready for a great day. So don't worry if you have a large bed. Sheiks comes with deep pockets, so they'll fit your mattress perfectly. So what are you waiting for? You deserve a comfortable, wonderful night of uninterrupted sleep. So visit trysheiks.com/Laura. That's trysheiks.com/Laura. And use the code Laura, you'll get 25% off your purchase. Plus, you're going to receive free shipping, a bonus pair of pillowcases, and a 30-night risk-free guarantee. Try Sheiks, sheiks.com/Laura, code Laura. Trysheiks.com/Laura, code Laura. By the way, the Vatican has released a document on gender theory. This has been long anticipated and long awaited. A lot of people have problems with Pope Francis, think he's too liberal. We're concerned that this was going to be opening the door to a reconsideration of. I never thought that, but a lot of people did. And they came down with basically a very traditional document about the understanding of male versus female. And so we'll get into that in just a moment with Bill Donahue from the Catholic League. And what does all this mean? But first, well, now they're not only welcoming kids to drag queen story hours, they're encouraging kids to themselves become drag queens.
I'm Desmond. I'm 11 years old, and I like pizza, trains, and drinking root beer since it's caffeine-free.
I also do drag, and I love to put on makeup, dresses, and wigs, and of course, jewelry if necessary.
My full drag name is Desmond is Amazing. I love doing drag because it makes me feel amazing and self-expressive. It just feels amazing to know that people love what I do. My one big message would be three words: be yourself always.
Wow. Joining us now is Bill Donahue from the Catholic League. Bill, there's a piece in National Review by Madeline Kearns about this little boy, and the title is Desmond is Amazing, Needs Saving, about this this little boy and what's happened to our youth, their innocence, before puberty even, trying to change kids' understanding of just, or you know, basic concepts, or sexualize them and destroy their innocence. What's happening here?
Well, this is child abuse. I mean, let's call it for what it is. And the people behind this, I want to make it clear, the average gay person is probably no more interested in this than the average straight person. And you know, I haven't got enough gays in this country, if they lined up single file, to pull this kind of eroticization of our society together. No, you couldn't do it without the help of an awful lot of straight people. Almost all of them are straight people. They may be guided by gay activists, and there's a difference between a gay activist and a person who's not an activist, obviously. And those are the ones I'm talking about. But this is an attempt, basically it's an assault on nature and on nature's God. That's what it's really about. It's about the family, of course, and everything else, and they're using radical individualism as their spear. But it's basically an assault on nature. They're trying to deny the existence of nature, that there are fundamental, profound differences between men and women, rooted not in culture, but in nature. And that's what we're up against.
Well, I think when you look at this new, you know, again, contrived controversy, and it's started as a group of activists in San Francisco in 2015, who decided, how do we sell this gender fluidity concept and get publicity and grow this movement? They grow it by starting this drag queen story hour organization in San Francisco in 2015, happens to coincide with the rise of Donald Trump. They start this organization, and then they export it across the United States and get all these liberal reporters to write pieces about these intolerant Christian conservatives and Catholic groups who are expressing outrage that even the public libraries are turning into these little political and social transformation instruments.
Well, a number of years ago, I wrote about the public libraries hosting NAMBLA. That's right, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which believes if he's 8, he's too late. If they're organized for one purpose, to sexually molest little boys and girls, mostly boys. And they organize and meet for the purpose of molesting kids in public libraries at public expense and defended by the American Civil Liberties Union. So it's not a great leap. Now, you talk about intolerance. The Vatican puts out a document which simply restates the obvious, that there are fundamental differences between men and women. And last night, the most filthy-mouthed comedian on television today, Trevor Noah, goes off and says things which I cannot and will
we're gonna
not
play
say
some
on
of
your
it.
Podcast.
Yeah, well, we're going to play
it's
some
absolutely
of it.
Absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, let's play. We'll play some of it, the stuff that we can play. Let's listen.
Oh, and get this. Part of the Vatican's rationale is that transgender people go against its belief that God made men and women to reproduce, which, first of all, transgender people can reproduce. And secondly, again, why do you care? Right? You don't even let your people reproduce, right? Nuns aren't allowed to have sex, right? Priests can't get little boys pregnant. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Horrific person. Yeah, I mean,
well,
just...
you know, we've been dealing with some of the people at Viacom before, but I just, before I went on the air here with you, Laura, mobilizing the staff, we have the names. I'm going to put out a statement on Trevor Noah shortly.
Oh, I'll help you on this.
Following our victory in Michigan with this Trump nominee who was terribly flawed. But this thing here is amazing. We've got the names and the addresses now of all the top people who work at Viacom. They've got to do something about this. And I don't want to be lectured by one more person on the left that the people who don't agree with civility and the people who are intolerant are conservatives. Nobody would put this guy on television if he attacked homosexuals as much as he attacks the Catholic Church. And of course, he misrepresents the Church's teachings, which that's all deliberate, too. Either that or they're just plain fools. But this is what we're up against. In my lifetime, I've never seen such an all-out frontal assault by moral nihilists who are morally bankrupt on the traditional values that this country was rooted in.
Again, so much of this comes down to advancing an agenda by using children and manipulating the thoughts and the natural understanding of children. That's where I have a real, real concern, and I'm not alone.
Yeah, they want to get their hands on the kids. There's no question about that. And this whole idea of changing your sex, they're not changing your gender. That's social roles that are learned from nature. Changing your sex. This started in Johns Hopkins University in the medical school back in the 1960s. And it was started by people some of whom I think had good intentions, others whom I don't think. I know quite a bit about this subject. But forget about the motive there. They started it back in the 1960s at Johns Hopkins. And after about two or three decades, they came to the conclusion, most of them at least, that not only does it not work in the sense of making somebody happy, but approximately 9 years after the people make the sex change, there's a big spike in the suicide rate. Now, this is not only true in the United States. It's true in places like Sweden.
Well, yeah. Well, Paul McHugh, who is the leading researcher at Johns Hopkins on and has been for decades on this gender fluidity movement, the medical research behind it, sex reassignment, this idea of sex reassignment, it doesn't work. It's impossible to reassign someone's sex physically, and attempting to do so doesn't produce good outcomes psychosocially. And this was written initially as a synopsis by Ryan Anderson, who's a PhD also, and this focuses on this area for the Heritage Foundation. But McHugh is the distinguished service professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. And he said, transgendered men do not become women, nor do transgendered women become men. All, including people like Bruce Jenner, become feminized men or masculinized women, counterfeits or impersonators of the sex with which they, quote, identify. In that lies their problematic future. And that's where you get the psychological problems.
I have a chapter called Sex Equality in a new book called Common Sense Catholicism. And I address this issue. And in fact, I mentioned Jenner, and I said he can't menstruate. Okay? Can people get that through their head? He can't menstruate. He will never be a woman. He will always be a male. You can't change your chromosomal makeup. I mean, this is madness on stilts. And the idea that it's coming from the academy doesn't surprise me. That's where the loons are. They used to be in the asylum. Now they have tenure. And they're teaching this stuff. It bubbles down, percolates down into the culture itself. What really is amazing to me, though, Laura, more than anything else, the one segment of the population that I am most really disheartened with, because they've totally dropped their guard altogether, that's the corporate elite of America. They are on board, from Amazon and the Silicon Valley to Goldman Sachs here in the Wall Street area. Kellogg, Macy's I'm right across the street from Macy's, the big one here in Herald Square in New York City. I was walking down the street the other day to get to a doctor's appointment on 34th Street, and I see they have all the rainbow colors out into the sidewalk. I guess New York City allowed them to do that. All over pride, pride, pride. Look, I don't care whether somebody's gay or not. I know people were discriminated against in the past, and I understand that, a lot of times unjustly. But the idea of people being pride, and by the way, how did this turn out to be a month? I thought it was a day. Yeah. Are we going to have St. Patrick's Day month? Or are we going to make March Irish month? Or I don't know. Where do we go with this
month? I'm kind of over all the months. Because I was a breast cancer, I had breast cancer. But if you like breast cancer month, I said it seems like for people who've had breast cancer, for us, we're always being very vigilant about our health and trying. So it's kind of all the time for us. So I'm not really understanding the month. But I guess it's just a time to have awareness about issues and so forth. But this is being done on the gender reassignment. And then the drag queen is different, because not all drag queens are transgendered persons or seeking sex reassignment surgery. There are lots of different topics here. But my point is, why are we dragging children into this debate? If you want to debate this as an adult and debate Paul McHugh and The Guardian in Britain did this piece that looked at 100 follow-up studies of post-operative transsexuals by Birmingham University's Research Intelligence Facility. And they found some really interesting things about post-operative transsexuals. And it was not at all conclusive that this was a good thing to encourage people to get this surgery. And so if we want to debate that, then that would be interesting among adults. But why do I have to drag the children into this? That is my concern.
Well, it fits in with the left's agenda. They're always driven by one word, power. And so what you're trying to do is to indoctrinate. And why not start it in the kindergarten? Go to the preschool if you can. Try to get kids when they're young, and try to get them their minds molded that this is acceptable. That's what they're teaching in schools now. And there's every kind of sex is all equal. One is not more dangerous than the other, even though that's obviously not true. They're trying to teach these kids that a boy can become a girl, and so Sally can become Sam, and Sam can become Sally. As Dr. McHugh pointed out, as you mentioned him before, these people are mentally ill. That is his considered judgment after dealing with this for decades. And we ought to treat these people and treat them as human beings for the maladies that they suffer from and not try to proselytize others. And then when people rightly object as parents that I don't want my kids subjected to this kind of indoctrination, this kind of perverse understanding of sexuality, then we're called intolerant. Yet they're the ones trying to shove their radical secular agenda down the throats of people, and they won't allow you to opt out. We've seen this in California, what's going on right now. There's no opt-out clause for any of this kind of stuff. And that's what they are teaching in the textbooks. And unfortunately, California is the gold standard of textbook that sets the standard for textbooks across the other 49 states. That's where they get their lead from. So, no, they don't want to allow choice for that to that extent. Obviously, the only choice they'd like is the choice to abort. But when it comes to parental choice, that's something the left will never tolerate.
Yeah, I'm looking at the American Psychiatric Diagnostic Manual, in the DSM, it's called, and they have the diagnostic criteria for gender dysphoria and transsexualism, gender identity disorder, and so forth. There's been a lot of political pressure put on the psychiatric community to destigmatize these what they called maladies, and to say this is not a condition, this is not a psychiatric condition, this is just a state of being. So they're under pressure and have been, and that's why someone like Paul McHugh, you'll rarely see him do an interview, because this is a man who's dealt in facts and long-term studies, follow-up studies of individuals. And so they can't really debate someone like McHugh on the facts. Bill, instead, they go straight to the politics. Love is love. You're a horrible person if you don't embrace this. And parents who don't bring their kids to this, you know, drag queen story time, they're also part of the right-wing white nationalist movement. I mean, so it's just a complete tarring of anyone who calls into question this, and I think sexualization of our kids.
And this actually began around 1970. It was 1973, the American Psychological Association decided that that homosexuality was not a mental illness. And that's fine if they want to come to that conclusion based on scientific evidence. But starting 3 years before that, around 1970, gay activists showed up at the convention, the American Psychological Association, every year to intimidate and call them Nazis and got their home phone numbers and addresses. This was all pressure politics coming from the left. There was no scientific evidence to suggest that they should change the diagnostic statistical manual whatsoever. And they did so because they caved in out of intimidation. This has pretty well been recounted. And now, of course, you got the psychiatric community on board as well. You got the corporations on board. You even have some of the churches. You mentioned United Church of Christ. That was Barry Lynn's church from the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. So we really got our hands full on this. The average American, of course, does want to protect his kid, but those who have parents, unfortunately, we're not reproducing the way we should. But the single people don't seem to care. But those of us who have parents and have kids, they're the ones who care about this stuff. And unless we can get to them and mobilize them, the left will simply take over altogether.
Yeah, just so everyone understands what Bill is referencing here, I think it's important to read it right from the ResearchGate.net, which publishes the American Psychiatric Diagnostic Manual, and you can read through all the changes over the years. And, you know, look, things change, and we understand that. But just listen to this. It's very, very interesting. In 1980, the American Psychiatric Association recognized transsexuality as a, quote, mental disorder. Revising this designation more specifically in 1994, as a, quote, gender identity disorder. Then, in 2013, the term for diagnosis was changed to, quote, gender dysphoria, in order to make it sound less pathological. And that's Zucker, the guy who wrote this for the manual. Another term that has been used in order to de-pathologize the diagnosis of trans identities is, quote, gender incongruence. So you see how the language has changed over time? And it's meant to ease it into the, you know, the common parlance, and also ease it into the common understanding and acceptance. But that's interesting. So 1980 from a mental disorder, and today it's gender incongruence, which sounds fine. I mean, it sounds, well, it's kind of incongruent, but what isn't?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I still hold on to some of my textbooks that I used to assign to my students in sociology, in social problem. And now, of course, everything's changed. But again, it changed not for scientific reasons. There was no empirical evidence that came out which said, no, previous ideas were wrong. It was all a matter of the politicization of the academy. As Robert Nisbet, the great sociologist, said a long time ago, we don't have any more social sciences. They're all political sciences. And it's on that basis that kids are just being told what to think on this. And of course, the media, Hollywood, the autistic community, now the corporate world, they're all lining up single file. And they've decided who's oppressed and who isn't oppressed. And that's why Trevor Noah can go ahead with his filthy mouth, ripping the Catholic Church with impunity, because they simply don't care. That's how much the moral destitution of some segments of the media has collapsed to such an extent that they would allow this kind of vile language used against any religion. It's part and parcel of the madness of our society today.
Bill Donahue, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And remember our fantastic conversation that we've been having about your skin in the summer. Now, summertime is tough on the skin. You got to put on the SPF and stay out of the sun as much as you can. Wear a big hat, and you know, I'm trying to drill this into my kids. But at the time you get older, your skin's been through a lot, so it needs more care. And give it some TLC with my friends at Chamonix, who make the great Genucel line of products. And Robin from Lubbock, Texas, loves a particular product, which I've been using now for probably 12, 13 months now. It's called the Genucel Jawline Cream. And you use it, you'll see it. She uses it, she's blown away. And after 2 or 3 days, you see the difference in the skin along your jawline and your neck. And it has this thing called the MDL technology, which targets that delicate skin in your neck, on your neck area, to help it look tighter and healthier looking. Now, you'll see the results quickly, and if you don't, 100% money-back guarantee, always, no questions asked. They're not going to hassle you. You'll get your money back, but I promise you, you're going to love these products. Remember, it's very easy. You text EYES1 to 77453. EYES1 to 77453, or just go to GenuCell.com now. Remember, you're going to receive the free under eye for bags and puffiness, that classic Genucel cream. You'll receive that free with your order of the jawline and neck treatment. Again, it's very easy. Text EYES1 to 77453, or just go to Genucel.com, and you also get free shipping, which is very cool. Genucel.com.
I am Gia, and I am transgender. At the end of middle school, like 8th grade, I decided to come out to my friends and like tell them that I was transgender, and like this is how I've been feeling for like the past 13 years of my life. So I decided to write a letter to my whole entire school to let like everyone know what was going on. The letter just said that this is how I've been feeling for the past 13 years, and that I will be coming to school in, like, I guess, like, what society says, like, girls' clothes, and I'll be, like, identifying, like, with she, her pronouns.
Well, we've had a lot of changes in our schools over the years, and this one really is one of the most profound, where children are just sua sponte, that means seemingly out of nowhere, beginning to say, no, they're not wanting to be called a girl or a boy anymore. This is my new name, and this is who I am, and this is how I, quote, identify. It's been documented in Britain, and in some towns, there's been a 900% increase in the incidence of individuals, young people, calling themselves, quote, transgendered. What's going on here? And is there any concern, and it seems to be building, of children going down this road, some wanting attention, some having other problems, then inexorably altering their body, their development, and perhaps endangering their psychological futures, let alone their physical futures, And what of this? Do we need to have a conversation about this? We are talking about children here. Joining us now is Walt Heyer. He's the founder of the website Sex Change Regret. And it's a site for people who, of course, regret trying to change their genders. He joins us now. Walt, we've been talking about a lot of topics today. I mean, I love all people, and I always say I'm the most flawed person out there. So I'm I really try not to – I'm not going to judge people, condemn people. That's not my job. My job is to ask questions, and I hope to try to be fair as I do that. But there really seems to be a building consensus solidified in the popular culture and the mainstream media – that these types of, quote, reassignment surgeries and gender blockers for children, that they're fine, no problem, and it's just a logical choice for kids who you know, feel like they're not in the right bodies. What is your experience, and how can you inform us with it?
Yeah, working with the people, Laura, thanks for having me on. Working with the people who've been through this of all ages, what we find is that somewhere between 3 and 15 years after they transition, sometimes 20 years, they find that it's not what they thought it was going to be. They regret it deeply. They found that their body has been transformed beyond repair. They become even more deeply depressed after than they were before. And so what we're really dealing with, Laura, is what we call a social contagion. This is exploding, as you pointed out, only because other people are doing it. So this is this effect of people joining other people. It's a way to gain attention. Many of these young people who are identifying as transgender have had difficulty being accepted socially. And as soon as you identify as a transgender, you can suck all the air out of the room and become recognized, and you're a hero. And so we're dealing with what people have identified as rapid onset of gender dysphoria. What that really means is they don't have gender dysphoria. It's just a social idea. Boy, I can become popular immediately if I come out. People will recognize me. I'll become the center of attention. And so it's really very destructive. The long-term harm that comes from hormone blockers and engaging in cross-gender hormones and surgeries, we see very high rates of suicide, 19 times more likely to have a successful suicide by the people who've transitioned than the people who haven't.
Well, what can be done? You know, what can be done about this? In a culture where if you even raise the issue, now I know a lot of people who won't even talk about this because they're afraid of the backlash. And I just don't, you know, I just say, look, if you're honest about children and what children need and want and what, you know, what the science is, if you're honest about it, then you have to ask questions. You know, they're always accusing Christian conservatives and people who try to be, you know, traditional Catholics and just traditional people, period. They always accuse them of being anti-science. Right. And so now we're saying, okay, the world-renowned experts on this issue, like Paul McHugh and Paul Cruz, these people have actually done the work, peer-reviewed studies, actually done the long-term work, and their findings are disturbing.
Yeah,
disturbing.
Very disturbing. And Laura, what can be done? And I recently wrote a book that's been released. It's called Trans Life Survivors, and this is probably one of the ways that we can impact it, because it's very hard to come out publicly or have an effect in schools and say you shouldn't be doing this. But I found that people are grabbing this book. They're beginning to understand the destructive, because it talks about the destruction. There's 30 stories in there of people who've been through this of all ages. And it talks about their suicides. It talks about their attempted suicides and the destructive components of attempting to change genders. And so what we realize is nobody actually changes. They make themselves look different. But after a period of time, they realized that this is a masquerade. They really didn't change, that they were affirmed in this by, you know, their psychological help or from school or whatever. And then it fades away. And they don't have this desire to change genders anymore. And that's why my website gets hundreds of thousands of views. And that's why I'm working with people every single day of the week who are struggling to now detransition back and find peace after having gone through this. So it's very destructive. While it looks really good and there's a lot of people pushing for this at the outset, the downside is horrible, and that's why, like, Paul Ruse and McHugh, who are friends of mine, have got the data. They've done the research, and it's destructive, and we shouldn't be promoting transgender ideology.
Even in the summary of the diagnostic changes of how they diagnose, people, individuals with gender dysphoria, which is the new way they refer to this, it's been a changing nomenclature since 1980. And I just right. Documented that in reading from the diagnostic manual. This is not a conservative website. They're even concerned about the gender. This is like a footnote five. I'm into the footnotes. This is how geeky I am. The gender dysphoria criteria for children are potentially more conservative than they were in the DSM-4-TR because the current criterion and its eight symptoms is now a necessary symptom for the diagnosis. And in total, the criterion pertains to the child's strong desire to be the other gender or some alternative gender different from one's assigned gender. The tightening of the requirement for caseness will likely sharpen the distinction between a diagnosis of gender dysphoria and normative variation. I think more people are concerned now than ever, more than ever, that children respond to the power of suggestion. And that in many of these cases, the children are seeing through the power of suggestion and glamorization in the popular culture that this is a way to be accepted. And they might be suffering in many ways of things going on at home, or they might be upset about various things in their lives. But it's very, very important that children are not improperly diagnosed and then put on a track for procedures or medication whose long-term effect we do not know. Is that correctly stated?
Absolutely correct. And keep in mind that the diagnosis for gender dysphoria is consistent, insistent, and persistent. But also those three components, that's all it takes to be diagnosed as a child with gender dysphoria. That also is the same way and criteria used for mental disorders. If they're struggling from depression or bipolar disorder, anything else, consistent, persistent, and insistent that it's continued. These are all the same things you use to diagnose mental disorders. So we're diagnosing children and putting them on a path that's very destructive for them. And it's just way too easy for them to say, I feel like I'm a girl, if they're a guy, and then for mom to say, oh, well, you're probably transgender and you should change your name and get a different pronouns. And this is absolutely what happened to me. It was very destructive. I've been dealing with this now for 74 years. There is nothing good about it except my detransition in 1990, and I've been speaking about it ever since. And that's why I mentioned again my book, Trans Life Survivors. It has the stories in there about children and why it's important for parents to read this book before they affirm and guide their children down a transgender path.
Just so people understand your own story, 1990, I mean, I didn't even know this was a thing in 1990. What happened to you specifically and briefly?
Well, I was a four-year-old kid who today would be considered a transgender kid who was cross-dressing, and I was affirmed as a young child and began to have that seed of, and we didn't have the word dysphoria then, but to be the idea that I should have been a girl went on until I had surgery at age 42. And lived 8 years as a female until I began to study psychology and realized this is a psychological disorder. Then, so if we spend the time to understand how they got there, and sometimes it's a disorder of being affirmed and guided and supported in a cross-gender identity, because this is where the dysphoria begins, is in the affirmation process, and how destructive is child abuse to affirm a child in a cross-gender identity. So I came out of this in 1990, and we've been helping people. We've helped hundreds of people now find their way back, and that's part of what's in the book. And so,
but there are a lot of people who will say, there, you know, I've met some transgendered folks over the last few years, and they seem really happy. I've got to say, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate. They seem really happy, sure. and they're living, you know, their own truth, and they're living their own experience, and you know, I really like them. They're great people, and I just happen to have met them through friends or through work, and you know, so they would say, well, I'm sorry you had a bad experience, but that's not our experience, and we have a lot of friends who don't have that bad experience at all. So what do you say to them?
Yeah. Well, I say that I was one of those people that they interviewed who had a good experience during the 8-year period. And so, you know, what we know is it's a temporary reprieve. At some point between 3 and 20 years, that experience may not happen. Now, if it goes beyond that, and what we found out is that people most likely are not transgender, but are actually suffering from autogynephilia. And so the people who are autogynephiliacs will continue to persist in this cross-gender identity because of what autogynephilia is. It's not really transgenderism. So being able to pull these things apart and begin to understand what autogynephilia is and what transgenderism is and what being a drag queen is or transvestic fetish is really important. And that's why the book Trans Life Survivors will help people pull this stuff apart.
All right. We really appreciate your story. Paul Heyer, founder of the website Sex Change Regret, here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. And let's go to Liz in Pennsylvania. Liz, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say that, you know, I do think that this is affecting my children. I have 4th and 6th grade daughters. Yesterday, my daughter at school was told by many other kids by leaving stickies on their desk to make sure you wear a gay pride shirt tomorrow in support of their, you know, agenda. My daughter said that I don't support that because that's how she was raised, and they kind of really gave her a hard time.
They bully her? And I bet they bullied her.
They definitely bullied her. They said, what is wrong with you? Why do you hate gays? And my daughter is very
strong, a
4th grader, and said, I don't hate anybody. I just don't support this lifestyle. And, you know, they really came at her and bullied her. So I did call the school, and thank God the school did do something about it. I will give them that. But it's being pushed so much in the town with picketing, in the libraries, with drag queens. It's just pushed that all I'm asking is, can we stop pushing it on our children?
No, they can't.
I'm raising my child not to think that way. I'm not raising them to hate them, just that we should be able to have our beliefs also.
No, that's not that you're what you have to understand is, no, they will not allow you to have your beliefs. They will try to run you out of town. They'll try to demonize you. They'll try to run people off the air who disagree with the prevailing wisdom. They want to shut down debate because the debate takes them to an uncomfortable place. An actual debate where it's not imbued with all sorts of slogans that sound nice with, you know, with colors that look nice. A real debate about the science and the facts. It's very different, isn't it? I mean, it's a different, you end up in a different place. Or you just say, look, I love all people. I'm not judging anybody, but this is not what we believe. So why do they get to have their truth, but you don't get to have your truth? That's my question, when I know the answer to, is because they believe you and your daughter and all traditional Americans are an existential threat to their continued advancement. That's what they believe. And they believe America's history and this traditional Christian heritage is itself deeply flawed and, in fact, in many ways, evil. So that's what they believe. Hey, stay on hold, Liz, because I want to find out more about what's happening in that particular school. But stay on hold. We're going to let me talk to you off air. Let's go to Trent in Alabama. Trent's a middle school teacher. Trent.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me, and I just want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing. We thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
I teach children. I've been doing it for about 23 years now. I have a daughter myself, and it's just, it's evil. And these kids are impressionable. Let a kid be a kid. Let these parents be able to opt out of programs before just putting them in places and environments where they're going to hear things like this. It's crazy.
Well, again, they need the kids, though, don't they? They need the kids. They, without indoctrinating children on a whole variety of issues, whether it's abortion or any of these other issues, without that, the movement kind of dies out. So they need the kids. They need to turn the kids into their own little community organizers, activists, across the board on a whole host of issues. And this is just one of the more, I think, potentially destructive issues, which is trying to get little children sexualized. So they become sexual beings. And I think a lot of this is geared toward lowering the age of consent for children, too. In other words, if you can change your gender and say, I'm changing my gender at age 7, why couldn't you say, well, who are you to say children can't have sexual intercourse? You see what I'm saying? Like, if you as a child can make a decision that would lead to perhaps permanently altering your existence as, you know, as someone who can reproduce or your body, or if that's the case, then why can't you do what you want with your body, including have sex? I'm not the first one to say this. This has been written about for many, many years. I appreciate the call. Hey, everybody, you have to check out this amazing new true crime podcast. It's called 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. It's about a murder that took place not far from where we are here in Washington, D.C. A family, their housekeeper, they were held hostage for 19 hours before being killed when the murderer set their mansion on fire. You'll be shocked by what they went through during those 19 hours, and you won't believe how they found the guy. Keep an eye out for a special sneak peek extra episode this week here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. And if you can't wait, download 22 Hours, An American Nightmare now on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One with new episodes every Monday.
A burning mansion. In the flames, a terrible secret.
Appears to be intentionally set.
It shook that community to the core, especially when those horrific details started to come out about what happened inside that house.
A mother, father, 10-year-old son, and the family housekeeper, all held hostage for almost 20 terrifying hours. Finally, a ransom in cash. But it doesn't save the helpless captives. Only the smoke escaping out a window. This in a wealthy Washington enclave, the vice president's neighborhood.
This could happen there? What about the rest of us ordinary Joes? What chance do we have?
Well, this was a horrific, horrific situation in upper northwest Washington, close to where I used to live, and also heartbreaking, completely heartbreaking. Megan Cloherty and Jack Moore are award-winning WTOP reporters. Megan and Jack host the new podcast called 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. And this particular story, of course, from 2015, is one that we in Washington, I think we go through a lot in D.C. with politics and the news business. But this was particularly horrific. A little boy was also involved, and I happen to know a mom and whose son was in his class, and what the little children had to be told about that child's death in its aftermath. And both Jack and Megan join us now to tell us more. Guys, thanks so much for being on with us, and I'm kind of reliving the days around this horrible triple murder. Tell us what the podcast is going to uncover.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Laura. So just to kind of recap, you heard a little bit in that introduction, but, you know, this, as the prosecutor said, when this case finally came to trial last fall, this is a case that nightmares are made of. A wealthy D.C. businessman, his wife, his 10-year-old son, and the family's housekeeper were held hostage in their own home for 22 hours, which is where the title comes from, then brutally killed. And the first inkling that we had of anything that had gone wrong in this house was when firefighters showed up because the house had been set on fire. And the firefighters raced in there the middle of the day. You know, typically you think a day fire might not be all that concerning, maybe a chimney fire or something. And they make this horrifying discovery. And that was the beginning of this case that captivated and horrified not only the region, but the country.
And then so what was also interesting about this case was, as you mentioned, it happened in May of 2015 on a seemingly completely normal day for the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa. And it was 3 years until Darren Wendt, who was convicted in the crime, went to trial. And so Jack and I went to every day of that 6-week trial. And there was just so many details coming out that, you know, in the 24-hour news cycle that we're in anymore, we had trouble covering everything we wanted to cover, let alone, you know, the big days where people really are tuning in to see what happened. So we just thought it was a crime, you know, not only just because of how horrible it was, but because of how many questions we had and just the defense. Oh, there were a lot of things to this that made it interesting and worth retelling.
And we should also state that the housekeeper was also ended up losing her life later on in the hospital. So this was, you know, this was beyond comprehensive. And again, it was just hundreds of yards from the vice president's residence on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C. So it's a very, very expensive neighborhood right across from St. Albans School. Let's talk about his business, the father's business, Mr. Savropoulos. I heard a lot of, you know, and I don't know what's true and what's not, but there was concern about his own, you know, business dealings in the past and whether some of that might have come into play.
Yeah, we talked with homicide investigators and they said, of course, when something like this happens, you immediately look to any possibility to find a lead. But Sava Savopoulos was the CEO of American Ironworks, which was a metalworks company, and worked, you know, essentially construction and worked in a lot of cash, which actually ended up being a part of the crime because he helped facilitate the ransom that was dropped off at his house and left in his $700,000 sports car in the garage. I mean, as you said, this wasn't really a normal family as far as the socioeconomic class. They're very wealthy. But yes, that one of the first things that police looked to was, does this have anything to do with his business dealings? Was there a deal that went bad? And it turns out it did, but not in the way maybe you might suspect. The killer worked for Sava Savopoulos as a welder 10 years earlier, which to me kind of, there was a lot of questions there too. I mean, why would you, you know, why would you wait 10 years or hold a grudge for 10 years? It didn't really all match up to me, but that's the connection. Is he used to work for Mr. Savopoulos.
So he wanted a $40,000 ransom, correct? And how did that, you know, how did that come into play? And the prosecution said they were, that Wendt was trying to destroy the evidence by setting the house on fire, and with the, you know, with the parents, Savropoulos, his wife, and the little boy inside.
Right, and that's one of the kind of really haunting things about this case. I mean, there are many, but the fact that while the family and Vera Figueroa were being held, many of the victims were making calls to the outside world. So that's how the $40,000 ransom was arranged. Sava Savopoulos was calling people at his company, calling his assistant. And for the most part, those calls were not raising any red flags. Now, after the fact, in hindsight, people at the business thought, well, you know what? The request for that amount of money in cash was a little odd. He'd never done that before. But the amount really wasn't because he would frequently go to auctions to get this really kind of specialized metalworking equipment, and you know that would run, you know, many thousands of
dollars. But I gotta say, guys, I mean, when this case first exploded in D.C., you know, so many of my friends and I, again, we lived right near there, were saying, "Wait a second, can you imagine if like one of us called, like, I need $40,000?" It's a little, it's, you know, it also makes you us all think when something is strikes you as odd. Don't just let it go. You know, I know it's like you can look back and hindsight is 2020, but that was that same thought came into the mind of that woman in Maine. I think she was in Maine who saw Muhammad Atta, or in Boston. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was Maine or Boston, who saw Muhammad Atta's eyes. So he checked in for that ill-fated flight on 9/11. And I believe it was she who said, this has haunted me ever since because I thought he looked like evil. Like he was, there were evil eyes. And of course, he's end up being the mastermind of 9/11. But I'm just saying, when something seems odd to you, it's usually your inner sense, and it's usually correct.
Yeah, don't ignore your gut instinct. What was really weird, though, is one of the people he called was his sister. So we're not even talking about family or business colleagues. We're talking about family members. He was able to. I mean, I also think you have to remember. Prosecutor said, you know, Savas and Amy Savopoulos are doing absolutely everything they can to get out of there with their son alive.
To save their son. Save and their who knows kid. if the boy was being
sound
tortured.
As normal as possible to do that, you're going to do that. And I think that's a huge, you know, it's a huge part of the strategy, a huge part of the case.
So will you be doing this on the podcast on crimes, not just obviously in the D.C. area, but crimes across the country?
No, it's just this crime. I mean, we are local news reporters. We've never done a podcast before, and we put this together based on our reporting. So it ended up being very
fantastic.
Tight. Yeah, it ended up being all evidence based. A lot of the evidence from the U.S. Attorney's Office here in D.C. We're making an appeal to the D.C. Superior Court here to release audio tapes that they don't consider public record, which we have challenged that. There's a lot to the podcast, and as we go through it, you know, it really is Jack and I going through with the listener because we presented in chronological order. So a lot of it, as we're revealing, you know, these details and how they fit, we're questioning them with the listener.
Well, I have a feeling that beyond this horrific situation with these murders, that this storytelling is going to be so compelling that you're going to do more of them. That's my sense. This is why people love podcasts, is because they love listening to story. And there's nothing like the audio format for getting people to focus, and especially well-produced stories about America, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and certainly the riveting. And we appreciate both of you so much, Megan Cloherty and Jack Moore. You've done phenomenal work for years for WTOP. Which is FM radio station here in D.C., and Podcast One's teamed up with you guys for this new true crime podcast. I'm just thrilled, and I'm so happy for you. Thank you so much for sharing the story, and I can't wait to hear it all.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks for having us.
You guys, absolutely, no problem. Best of luck. You are listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. I want to thank all of our sponsors who supported this podcast, among them Genucel, Delta Animal Rescue, and Sheiks. And we'll see you next time. Remember, America, now and forever. The Laura Ingraham Podcast.